I'm Elizabeth Vincentelli, and I write for The New York Times, The New Yorker, and Newsday.
I'm Terry Teachout of The Wall Street Journal.
And I'm Peter Marks of The Washington Post. Welcome to the latest episode of Three on the Isle, a podcast from New York about theater in America. We are hosted by American Theater Magazine, a publication of the Theater Communications Group. Elizabeth, Terry, good to be back with you.
And you as well.
It's our first podcast of 2018 and the start of a more ambitious schedule for Three on the Isle. Yes, you're going to hear even more from us.
If the world is ready.
Encouraged by the response to our theater discussions and interviews, we're going to try and double our output to two podcasts a month. Twice as much fun for us, and we hope for you. Today, Elizabeth and Terry are in our New York studio, and I'm speaking to you from Washington, D.C., where I regularly report on the theater.
And today, we're going back to a conversation we started on an earlier episode about the incidents of sexual harassment that are rocking the arts world. And, of course, we're going to focus on theater. The firing on January 23rd of Long Wharf Theater's artistic director, Gordon Edelstein, that's in Connecticut, has rocked the theater world and raised new questions about the practices in place for ensuring the safety of theater employees. We'll talk about this ever more troubling issue and the unusual impact it is having on the scheduled production of a play. Our podcast co-host, Terry.
I'm going to be talking about how this is affecting a production of my play, Satchmo at the Waldorf, that was to be directed in Houston in February by Gordon Edelstein at another theater, The Alley, where the artistic director's sudden departure has created a firestorm.
I think the only place now where you could safely get your play produced, Terry, would be at the Women's Project.
With Louisa Armstrong.
It's going to be the only
star.
One left standing.
Right. We'll also have a segment tackling a less anguishing topic, but still one that critics, playwrights, and audiences love to bat around, the merits of the talkback. You know, the post-performance ritual that allows theatergoers to hear from and ask questions of the actors and directors of the production they've just seen.
Well, you can count me among the people who wish the talkbacks could be walked back. I'm dying to hear what you guys, where you guys come down on this subject. To close out the episode, Terry, Elizabeth, and I will give you brief reports on the shows we've particularly admired, or didn't. But first, to the issue of sexual misconduct, and the new indications of how the issue is roiling the theater world. Edelstein, a director well known in the field who led Seattle's ACT Theater before arriving at Long Wharf in New Haven, has directed both on Broadway and extensively in regional theater. As the New York Times' Michael Paulson reported, Long Wharf's board fired Edelstein after an earlier article by Paulson in which he described allegations, quote, by multiple women, four of whom accused Mr. Edelstein of groping or other forms of unwanted touching. Several former employees, Paulson wrote, also said Mr. Edelstein frequently used sexually explicit language toward and about women in the workplace, unquote. Reports have surfaced of other longstanding artistic directors leaving their posts amid published accusations of other sorts of unbecoming conduct. In any case, I wanted to ask, and I think we're all interested in, the question of where are we headed? What are the conditions that have allowed this kind of behavior to go on by people who hold positions of great responsibility in the theater? And how do we ensure it stops? The allegations just keep coming, and I dare say there will be more. Terry, please, do you want to talk about this first? Because I think this has direct impact on you as pertaining to Edelstein.
Yes, in fact, in two different ways. I have been associated with Gordon professionally since 2012, when he directed the first major production of my play, Satchmo at the Waldorf. First at Shakespeare and Company in Lenox,
wow.
And then at his own Long Wharf Theater, then up at the Wilma in Philadelphia. And that's the production that transferred to Off-Broadway. The production has since been performed elsewhere, and the Alley Theater in Houston decided to produce it this season. As you know, Gregory Boyd, who has been the artistic director of the Alley for a quarter of a century, retired suddenly and without warning last month.
Quote unquote retired.
Right. With 2 days' notice, claiming that he had delayed his retirement because of the floods that damaged the Alley back in the fall. within a day or two, local news coverage made it clear that Boyd had been surrounded by accusations of harassment, both sexual and non-sexual, of different kinds. Presumably he left under pressure, although nobody knows that. The Alley has not yet said anything publicly about the whether there's more to the story than that. In any case, that's the background situation for what was going on at the Alley. My play is supposed to go into rehearsal next Tuesday, and the first preview is February 24th. Gordon Edelstein was directing the production, which would have been a remount of the off-Broadway production. On Monday, the Times broke this story. On Tuesday, the board of Long Wharf Theater fired Edelstein. And on Monday, although it wasn't announced then, the Alley decided to drop him from the production. With a week's notice, you sort of find yourself in a difficult position as regards getting another director of a show. Well, it happened that, of course, I have directed Satchmo at the Waldorf. I directed it at Palm Beach Drama Works in 2016. So it was immediately clear to me that we had a major problem. And on Monday, I got in touch with the Alley. I gave them a list of directors that had either worked on the show or that I thought would be good with it. And I also told them that it would be possible for me to step in and do it. We couldn't get anybody else to direct it at the last minute, and it was perfectly logical, since I had done it, for me to take over. So I agreed to do it late Monday night, and the announcement was made Tuesday that I would step in to this production. It's a very tricky circumstance in all sorts of ways. Gordon is a friend of mine and somebody who with whom I've been closely associated professionally. I have worked... Well, the period when I was working closely with him was in 2012. This was before, obviously, several years before the present harassment scandals broke. I never saw any inappropriate behavior engaged in by Gordon, and I didn't hear about it. On the other hand, I wasn't part of the company. I wasn't part of its daily life. I was a guest who came in to help rehearse my show. And I was staggered when the Times' story was published. I was staggered before that when the stories from Houston about Greg Boyd were published. Again, I had never heard anything about his own misconduct. But after the Houston stories came out, I began to hear from people, not in Houston, but on the East Coast, women who had never talked about it before, who told me that Boyd's conduct was quite well known in the business.
By women in the business. Is that what you're saying?
What I was told was that it was quite well known generally in the business. And it was a woman, more than one woman has told me this since then. Now, it happens that Satchmo at the Waldorf is a play, a one-man play, and I mean that literally. It's acted by a single male actor. It was directed by a man, and most of the production team was men. The set designer, the sound designer, the costume designer, Ilona Samogi, was a woman. And we've had some women stage directors or stage managers. But most of the time, it was all men in the studio when we were working at it. And Elizabeth, you and I were talking about this before, and you said you wondered how this might make a difference, and it's become dramatically clear to me in the last few days that, at least in the past, if men are engaging in inappropriate behavior, it was probably quite a bit less likely that women would volunteer this information to men. And that was the situation that I found myself in. I was talking to my wife about it, and I said, Hillary, was I doing due diligence? And back in 2012, if you all think back, it simply wouldn't have occurred to a man, at least, to ask himself, when he's in a theatrical situation, or really any kind of professional situation, am I working with somebody who engages in inappropriate behavior? If you don't see it, if you don't hear about it. And yet, as we all know from the events of the last few months, women have talked about this among themselves, what's called the whisper network. So one of the things that I've taken away from the events of the last few days is that it's always going to be difficult to guard against this kind of conduct. And I'm sure we'll have a lot more to say about that later in the broadcast. But one piece of insurance, long-term insurance, is to make sure that women are part of theatrical management, are in positions of power. Because if they're not, if you have a theater where the organizational structure is mostly, primarily, or exclusively men, it's obvious to us all now, women are going to be less willing, more reluctant
the other to come forward.
There's two, the problem, there's two things...
One of the problems is, as I see it, there are actually, I think the associate artistic director in this case was a woman at one point, and she was harassed. So it seems even more troubling than even just having women in the structure. There has to be a specific and potent set of rules and regulations and training of people to understand this issue.
And procedures for complaint resolution.
Well, I'm going to make three quick points here. One of the men to fall off his perch recently has been Albert Schwartz at Soul Pepper in Toronto. Soul Pepper is a huge part of the Toronto theatrical life. They've been around for a long time. Albert Schwartz created a company. Now, the process for grievances at Soul Pepper was if you had a grievance, you could go to, I can't remember her, one of the highest placed women at the company, who happened to be Albert Schwartz's wife. So nobody wanted to bring, it was very, very complicated to put forth. So you have a structure, you have to make sure that the structure is transparent enough and does not involve any kind of conflict of interest when you have spouses running a company. Number two, about the Houston Alley situation, I want to mention a very interesting tweet by a woman named Lauren Halvorsen. She's an associate literary director at Studio Theater, and she
in Washington.
I believe so. Yes.
Yes.
And she tweeted that. So she used to work at the Alley. And she worked at the LE from 2008 to 2011. So during her tenure there, so which obviously was under Gregory Boyd's, leadership, out of 34 plays, 4 were directed by women, 0 were directed by a person of color, and out of those 34 plays, 7 were by women, including 3 by Agatha Christie. And I think we have a real problem here. And I'm not sure that there's a connection between Gregory Boyd's conduct and, which let's say like the private conduct, and then the public leadership and running of an institution. But I just don't think it's a coincidence if you have someone who shows no respect for women on a personal level, that person is not going to be interested in having women's voices. 7 plays out of 34, I'm going to say 4, because 3 by Agatha Christie hardly qualifies, 4 plays by women, that is crazy in 3 years.
That is nuts. You cannot help but wonder when you see numbers like that. We should mention at this moment that a very important and perhaps representative appointment has just taken place in the theater world, which is that Pam MacKinnon is going to be replacing Carrie Perloff, who is retiring from ACT in San Francisco, a woman replacing a woman, and a woman who is also one of the prominent stage directors at the present moment. When we were talking to Lila Neugebauer last month, we observed that there's just been a wave of top-tier women starting to direct. There's no excuse for not using people like that. And the fact that ACT at this moment, at this juncture, at the height of, I hope it's the height of the harassment scandal, has hired Pam MacKinnon to take over, that's really a very important, not just a symbolic gesture, although the symbolism of it is very important.
She's replacing a woman.
I was just going to say, I think it's important to ask Terry, have you spoken to Gordon Edelstein at this point? Have you shot him an email and said, Gordon, what the hell? I mean, obviously, if you've had a relationship with him, I wonder if you've reached out to him.
I have emailed him. I have not heard from him. The press accounts are saying that he's not responding to any inquiries from outsiders. So there's nothing that I can tell you at this moment. I can tell you that a number of people that I have worked with, who have worked with him, we all feel the same way. We're shocked. We're stunned. But it turns out that there are a lot of women who are neither shocked nor stunned because they knew it was going on.
I'm also curious about this issue of whether or not this is, you know, has to do also with sort of the mythology that surrounds these leaders once they become empowered in each of these organizations. People are afraid to confront them, it seems to me. I don't think this is a particularly a theater problem. I think it has to do with men in all of these fields that we're finding this happening. But I do think that there is something even more sort of familial that happens in a theater company. It's such a tight-knit organization often that there is a greater fear perhaps even of confronting these men. And because the stories about the theater guys are coming out much later than it happened in other fields. We were hearing these stories, you know, in the film world and in the media world, you know, in November, and it's just starting to emerge in theater.
These are stories that have to be broken and covered locally first. You can't just parachute into Houston and know
right.
what's going on in
right.
Houston.
Right.
I mean, the Alley's doing a show of mine, and I didn't know about
right,
it.
Right, right.
It's our responsibility now as journalists, the three of us, our peers elsewhere, is going to be to ask the question instead of waiting for somebody to break it.
And actually, to go back to something Peter was talking about, the idea of the leader, one of the things, I mean, as with many artistic fields, there's this idea of the charismatic leader.
Mm-hmm, right.
Albert Schwartz was very much that. When Soul Paper came to New York for like a month long of presenting a whole bunch of their shows, I happened to spend a whole day there, like watching whole of parts of like five shows. He introduced every single one of them. The guy was everywhere. The guy was the company.
Mm.
And I think it's a very common phenomenon in theater to have, yes, that idea of the, especially when the director is also the artistic director. You have that person who's almost guru-like.
Right.
It's also happens a lot in acting schools. I'm sure Grotowski was probably completely nuts.
I'd put my vote in on that, yes.
You know, and something I really struggle with is it all worth it? Because when you see those shows that are completely crazy and nutty and go on for like 6 hours, that are very, very demanding on the actors and the staff, I sometimes wonder, like, what is the cost of this? I mean, it may not be
right.
sexual harassment. It can be like a kind of like psychological pressure. And I think we've heard those stories.
There are other ways
and
to harass
really,
people. Yeah.
There's many, many ways to create this kind of feeling. And some people say, well, you have to be pushed to your limit to elevate your art. And I'm really torn about that because sometimes I, from a spectator's point of view, I'm like, this feels dangerous. This feels like, I've seen shows where the actors had bruises on their body because the performances
right.
were so physical.
Right.
I tremendously admire the work, but is it worth it? It's really, part of me thinks, yes, I've got to admit it.
Well, I was going to say that, you know, an editor mentioned to me a rumor that they had heard about someone in the theater world that I deeply revere. I'm not going to say who it was, but even the thought of having to write in any way about that is so devastating to me. Even the thought of it, that I'm wrenched by the possibility that an entire career could come down to whether or not this person did something heinous that would completely it would shatter me. And that's why I was struck by what you said, Terry, about being staggered by this revelation. I mean, this is someone who presumably whose artistic judgment you felt respected deeply and grew to love at some level, I assume.
A sensitive artist.
I mean, loved his glass menagerie.
Yes.
Gordon Adelstein's.
I don't know how you process this.
The most beautiful Uncle Vanya I've ever seen, directed by him and translated by him. I simply cannot reconcile those shows with this behavior. And yet we know perfectly well from the history of the arts that this kind of thing actually happens all the time.
Right, right.
And
right.
Not just in theater.
Right.
Charismatic leadership is something that's baked into the cake of the performing arts. We're seeing a lot of conductors, James Levine, Charles Dutoit, who are going down under circumstances like this.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an ingredient. It's like one of those vitamins where the fatal dose and the healthy dose are extremely close to each other. I don't really think we can do without it. I don't think we want to. But we have to control it, and we have to have ways of well, Elizabeth, as you said a moment ago, you have to have a fireproof reporting procedure where you're not suddenly going to be talking to somebody's boyfriend.
And also, I think we need to mention the horrible conduct of those institutions' boards. Those boards have been ineffectual at best. I mean, that happened. We saw that at the Met, at New York City Ballet. It's repeatedly the boards are complicit in what's happening. There have been payments. Mm. I do not understand how the boards have not been aware of that. That is just impossible to me that boards would not know about payments that have been done for hush money. It is crazy to me. The boards should be fired and not with the severance that Gregory Boyd, by the way, Gregory Boyd at the Alley got almost $400,000 in severance, which probably has to do with his quote-unquote retiring as opposed to being fired. Very good move on his part. But it is bewildering to me, that the boards have been so complicit in this.
Well, we know how boards typically work in arts organizations. They have social value. They're fundraising tools. They don't think of themselves in the way that the board of a corporation might think of itself.
Might at least theoretically think of itself
as having a fiduciary responsibility, where the first responsibility of a board is to ensure the succession and to be responsible for whether or not the present leader is somebody who ought to be in the job. And I think it's just a matter of time before boards, and I'm thinking particularly the Metropolitan Opera Board, are put under very close scrutiny for their failure to deal with these matters. And that's going to change people's attitudes when they're invited to serve on a board,
right?
And they ask themselves, "Is this something I want to do?
Well, that's
a responsibility I want to have."
That's very true. And many people join boards because of the charismatic leader. That's what they're drawn to. That person makes them want to commit themselves and their money to an organization. And I don't think there's a board member anywhere in this country who joins a board wanting to deal with this kind of issue. I mean, they're just not – I don't think they're at all equipped, you know, 95% of them to deal with this kind of thing. So there is this, you know, this issue of, you know, you're devoting your spare time to this cause that you believe in deeply. And now suddenly you're a policeman for the behavior of your artistic director.
One of the problems is the artistic director – part of their job, they have to put together seasons. They have to sweet talk donors, and they have to work hand in hand with board members. And there is an unhealthy symbiosis in this quest for money, which there's no solution to that. It has to be done. But I think it does create a problematic relationship between the artistic director and the board, in that they're in together to try to raise funds constantly. And it just creates creates opening for a lot of instances of complicit behavior.
Yes. Well, this problem, I think it's quite clear from our discussion so far, it's not going to solve itself. But there is a force operating in the background that may make it easier to solve, and that is that we are seeing a generational turnover in theatrical leadership. Greg Boyd is 66 years old. Gordon Edelstein is 63 years old. Boyd had been at the Alley for 28 years. Gordon had been at Long Wharf for a decade and a half. The same thing is true of other institutional leaders around the country. The problem itself, I'm sure, has a generational aspect, which is that these are people who came up at a time when this kind of behavior, as repellent as we all find it now, was not talked about and therefore not as scandalous. They are older. I'm sure that many of them are dumbfounded. They've just been doing what they've been doing for the last 30 years. Why is it suddenly radioactive? But one way or another, either by being booted out because of misconduct or simply reaching retirement age, they are going to move on and they are going to be replaced by younger people who have come up under the aspect of a different perception of what acceptable behavior is. I cannot imagine that somebody like Pam McKinnon would think for 10 seconds that any form of behavior like this is acceptable in any possible way. Carrie Perloff certainly didn't think so. And I think we're going to see, not coincidentally, more women coming into leadership positions because they will be seen as insurance.
Yeah, we've heard of instances of just horrifying harassment at places like Vice Media, which of course is part of their image, but it's still a much younger generation. It's the same problem that we run into, and it's weird, but to me it's part of the same mentality where women are still, for instance, handling more of domestic tasks at home. That has not changed all that much. You would think, oh, younger men are going to handle more of that. No, they don't. Because why would they? They have it great. And that's why I'm thinking that some of the younger men that are coming up may also not be tempted to change something that's been working for them or for their elders for generations. So
well,
I'm a little less optimistic.
There'll be one big difference with those younger men. They will have seen older men go down.
That is true.
Misbehavior.
Very true.
The
price of that behavior is a lot more obvious now.
This discussion is going to be very interesting 6 months from now.
And I think the one of the indicators that things might change is the fact that we are devoting so much discussion to this. We are trying to illuminate this issue and draw it out. So that's a good sign, to say the least.
And Peter, as you said a moment ago, and I before, we're dealing with our own shock, our
right.
own astonishment.
Right.
And as men, we're dealing with the fact that it's men who are doing this,
mm-hmm.
and that women didn't feel comfortable telling us
right.
about it.
I mean,
I think of myself as somebody who is enlightened about matters like this, but I didn't notice people lining up to whisper in my ear, oh, by the way, so-and-so is a no-good bastard. We as men are going to have to become proactive about asking ourselves, am I doing due diligence? Am I seeing what I ought to be seeing? Am I talking to the people I ought to be talking to? And are people reluctant to talk to me for some reason?
Well, I think that's a good point to end this discussion and shift to another, which I bet many of our listeners have strong feelings about. I know I do.
Less fraught, yeah. But still.
Right. Terry, Elizabeth, it's no longer enough that a theater puts on a play. Now it has to also produce the after play. This ever more ubiquitous session is called the talkback. From my point of view, the ordeal in which exhausted actors are summoned back to the stage after an often grueling performance and are compelled to comment on what's just transpired on the stage. For theatergoers who care to stick around and ask questions or bask for a little while longer in a performer's radiance, David Mamet famously has rankled many, at least if you believe the protest tweets and angry posts on Facebook, with his policy of fining any theater that dares to schedule a talkback after one of his plays. While I think monetary penalties are too severe, I do understand why he finds the practice offensive. Should not a work of art speak for itself? Terry, you've got personal experience of this one as well. But do you either of you share my aversion to this trend?
No, I'm really not. I'm not. First, I'll say that what really rankles me about David Mamet is what happens before the talkback. That's my problem with David Mamet plays. It's not the talkback. I'm fine with the talkback. It's what's before, especially in the past 10 years. But listen, I don't understand why he's so just adamant about this. Nobody forces him to go. It's not impacting the play itself. I just do not understand. But then I do not understand him at this point. He's like mysterious. He's like the monolith from 2001. And I do not understand the Mamet monolith and why he keeps getting produced with the garbage he's putting out. There's no other word. So he's such a legacy playwright at this point that it's like the slate has to be like just wipe clean.
I think he's also an outlier in this discussion, though, too. He's taking an extreme and, if I may say so, rather showy position that he's going to fine people for doing it. Nobody else is doing that. There are people like the actor Patrick Page who I think have more reasoned objections to talkbacks. Patrick has said, am I remembering correctly, that that part of the motivation for them is because that's how you get funding for
Possibly. I think the thing with talkbacks is nobody's forcing anybody to do anything. I mean, at least from the audience's perspective.
But I think it diminishes the experience when it's a lousy talkback. You can see great play, and then the after play is terrible. I have conducted talkbacks. I have sat through talkbacks, and you know, often they're self-serving, short. I'll grant you fairly short events, but that they rarely shed light on what's come before. They seem more a gimmick, a marketing gimmick by theaters that think they have to give bonus aspects to the evening to justify the high price of the tickets. But I think that, you know, if they were great events that were really managed well and beautifully moderated always, and they were more revealing in some way of the people involved, I would say, you know, go for it. But often they're just garbage.
That's a reasonable objection. And before I got into the talkback racket, my general feeling about them was that I never went to them. I headed right up the aisle. But, you know, now that I have a parallel life as a playwright and director, I am taking part in them. And then as part of the Wall Street Journal's, one of its promotional programs, the WSJ Plus program, I've actually moderated talkbacks for two Broadway shows, Present Laughter and The Band's Visit. So I've worked both sides of the street, and I've talked to a lot of the people who attend them afterwards. Audiences, the people who come to talkbacks, they're really excited by it. They really see it as an opportunity to learn, to find more, particularly to find out more about the process, what's happening on the other side of the proscenium. And of course, Peter, if it's done poorly, it's not worth the time. But if it's done with sensitivity by people who are comfortable talking well, and if it's moderated by somebody who's prepared for it, and that's something that I always am scrupulous about doing, then you can create an event in which the audience really does learn something and get something out of it. Mm. So I've shed my cynicism about talkbacks from having done now, I don't know, gosh, I've done a couple of dozen of them by now in all sorts of different formats. But it's something you have to want to do. You shouldn't feel dutiful about it. The people who take part in it shouldn't be dragged into it. And the moderator should be somebody who's carefully prepared. But really and truly, if it's done well, it truly is it's a great way to increase the audience's sense of being vested in the experience of theater. And that can't be a bad thing.
I have no problem with people gathering after a show to talk among themselves about what they've seen. I just feel as if artists present what they do, and then that's for the rest of us to digest. And just the way we do this in criticism, I think it's a reflection of the same impulse. I just don't want the playwright and the and who's prescribed an amount of time for us to take in a piece of art, to have a second bite at the apple. And I don't think, and I think that's sort of what Mamet objects to.
Before we move on, let me offer to our listeners who might be involved in planning talkbacks a piece of hard-learned practical advice from having done a lot of them. And that is, don't put too many people on the stage. Mm-hmm. I have learned that a moderator and at most three people, preferably two, is the right number of people, because otherwise the conversation becomes crowded. It really isn't a conversation at all. Somebody's likely to get squeezed out of it. The audience doesn't know who to talk to. You want the experience to be controlled and linear and straightforward. And for me, at least, the best way to do it is to keep the panel small. I offer this for the consideration of everybody out there in the listening audience who's thinking of doing this.
And my advice will be to people in the audience at TalkBacks. It's not about your opinion. Please ask questions.
Yes. Oh, God, yes.
And my advice is, don't do them. So let's move on from there, Elizabeth and Terry, and talk about some experiences in the dark that we've loved lately, and maybe some that we didn't. We have just
the fist fight segment.
The fist fight segment. We have a bit of time to discuss the best or even the worst of what we've seen lately. Elizabeth, do you have any thoughts that you want to start us off with?
Was there a show that you really hated lately, Elizabeth, that other people really liked?
Why, I wonder. There is, Terry. Should I start with that?
Yes.
Okay. As soon as that John Lithgow at the roundabout started, like I would say within... You know, that there's, I love saying like that quote about theater. Theater is that thing where after 2 hours, you look at your watch... and 5 minutes have passed. That was me. I first looked at my watch at that show, like I would say within 10 minutes of the start. And I remember thinking, this is going to be a long, excruciating night. And it was. I was so right. I could not endure that kind of this horrible bonhomie that he has. Just, it was like nails on a blackboard for me. And I very much like John Lithgow as an actor.
Yes.
So it's really not, but this fireside chat, that radio play approach to less so for the... So let's explain. The show is John Lithgow talking a little bit about his family and his life.
Right. It's called John Lithgow's Stories to Tell, and it's playing at the Roundabout.
Stories by Heart.
Stories by Heart.
And it's playing at the Roundabout Theater's American Airlines Theater on Broadway.
And there's a very nice looking armchair, and this is a fake English study loctoid, which just... So the first act is mostly his reading a Ring Lardner story, and the second act is a Woodhouse story, which... just raise my hackles in every single... I knew you weren't there, Terry, because I would have recognized that laugh. So I knew for sure you weren't there the night I saw it. I think my mind just disjuncted, like I went half comatose. I do not see the point of this. I do not see the point of this show. It could be a book on tape. I do not get it. I'm clearly not the audience for that. I cannot stand pretty much any story... where a British toff named Pongo is the center will drive me bonkers.
All right, simmer down.
See how much I loathed it.
Simmer down.
Conversely, okay, now I'm going to talk about two things that I really liked. One was one of the craziest shows I've seen. I have no idea what was going on. Unfortunately, it's over. It was a rock opera called Electric Lucifer at the Kitchen. It was in January, and it was completely bonkers. I really cannot really tell what was going on, but it's one of those experiences where that leaves you completely stumped for words and meaning, and you're completely unsure what just happened. Some of it is not, it's not a good show per se, but it's a memorable show. There's not enough of those. And the one that I would really highly recommend is a very adorable little show called Cute Activist. It's at the Bushwick Star in Bushwick in Brooklyn by a fairly new company called New Saloon. And the company is made up of the playwright Milo Kramer, who wrote Cute Activist, the director, Morgan Green, and the actor, Madeline Wise. So all three are involved in that show. I loved it. It's a very surreal show about a millennial looking for meaning in her life, and she decides to become an activist after getting a prophecy from a talking mouse.
Cool.
It's that kind of show. It's very funny, and David Greenspan is also in it. And I love the idea that this veteran actor is working with this very, very green company. It's a kind of clash of generations, but that seems very harmonious on stage. Again, not a perfect show, but a very endearing, lovable one.
Thanks, Elizabeth. Terry?
Well, I liked the Lithgow show, but I know you did too, Peter, so I'll leave it to you to defend his honor. I'll just mention briefly two regional shows that I've seen. I've been on the road for the last couple of weeks. At People's Light, which is a theater in suburban Philadelphia, I saw a rare revival of Paul Osborne's Mornings at 7, which was one of the best productions of anything I've ever seen.
I love
anywhere.
That play.
Wow.
And it was done... It was a production of the highest possible quality. And then I went straight from there up to Washington, D.C., to see a company that was new to me, Constellation Theater, which is doing something I didn't think possible, a small-scale production of Thornton Wilder's The Skin of Our Teeth. Not perfect, but very impressive, and the play itself comes through very clearly. I would strongly recommend both of those shows.
Oh, that's great. Those are great, cool, offbeat choices. I would just say about Lithgow, Ms. Vincentelli, that I didn't think it was a radio play. What I loved about it was that it was such a physical play. I thought that that his piece really brought those short stories into three dimensions. The physicality is what made them, and made them specifically Lithgowian, if you will. So that made it for me a rationale for a one-person play. The show other thing I would talk about was the very highly anticipated Hamlet with Michael Urie at Shakespeare Theater Company in Washington, which unfortunately is Arnold Becker meets Elsinore. He has not unfortunately had enough time to move on from Torch Song, which he did so beautifully in New York, to contemplating a introspective Dane. He really is a totally externalized Hamlet, and it doesn't translate as a compelling interpretation. So, unfortunately, I look forward to Urie's work in the future. I don't think Michael Caine served him well in this case, but there you have it.
So a little too much cheese in that Danish.
Oh, beautiful.
Oh, God, woo! Sorry.
Very nicely done.
So bad.
Very nicely done. Well, that'll do it for us for today. We'll be back with another talkback episode soon. As always, I'm Peter Marks.
I'm Elizabeth Vincentelli.
I'm Terry Teachout, and you've been listening to Three on the Isle, a podcast from New York about theater in America, hosted by American Theater Magazine.
Our producer is Kirby Pate. You can follow us on Twitter at Three on the Isle. You can also write to us at threeontheisle@gmail.com.
Make sure you leave us a rating and a review on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for some exciting developments in the coming months. We'll see you next time on The Isle.